Liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer einer weiteren Folge der Interviews for Future. Die Einleitung ist kurz auf Deutsch. Wir wollen gleich aufs Englische übergehen, denn meine beiden Gäste sprechen Englisch. Es geht heute um Biodiversität in den Böden. Und hier gibt es eine interessante Untersuchung, eine Studie zur unterirdischen Biodiversität im Wandel. Lässt sich auch so gut recherchieren. Und nun wollen wir ein bisschen was darüber wissen. Welcome Eliana Duarte and Carlos Guerra. Hello.
So I'm Carlos, and I work at the IDEF, at the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research in Leipzig, but I also belong to the Halle University, and I'm an engineer from the past that more and more works with ecology and ecological problems in soils.
Hi everyone, I am Eliana Duarte and I am a mathematician. I am originally from Colombia and I used to work in Max Planck Institute for Mathematics in the Sciences as a postdoc, and I am currently a postdoc in the Mathematical Complexity Reduction Group in Magdeburg. And originally I was more interested in pure mathematics, but more recently I've been changing my focus to more applied concepts like statistics and causality.
Okay, and so it comes together that you're both, you're the main heads behind this research about underground biodiversity. And the goal of this research is for sure to show what is the situation still now, but with a look in the future, what will happen. That's right?
That's true. So there's a lot of research already being done at this precise moment about what are the current patterns of soil biodiversity. It's still very recent by comparison, for example, with plants. There we have plant atlas for decades, and we don't have a soil. So the first soil biodiversity atlas is from 2015, which is, by comparison, very, very recent. What we want more and more is not only to understand these patterns, but as Eliana was saying, we want to understand what drives these patterns, so what are the things that really matter for soil biodiversity. And part of those things we are learning are related to climate and to land use change. And with that information, we can also try to understand in the future with different futures, so with different ideas of what that future could be, what would be the impact on these soil organisms.
So biodiversity in the underground is something that's not visible. So if a wood is dying, we can see it. If something's happening there, we don't see. There is a visual, for sure you know it. It's a pyramid that shows on top the humans and then the mammals, and then it comes down and down and down. And on the base there is this where you make the research for the biodiversity in the underground, or the little ones, the bacteria and so on. This for sure is only a meme. But is it a true meme? So can we say it easily like this, that it's based, the higher life is based on this ground?
That's for sure. And actually, most of the impacts that we see, so most of the things, for example, when we lose fertility in the soil, when we have better or worse, in this case, crop production, this is already something of, it's an effect that of something that happened in the past to the soil. So we first did some type of damage to the soil community that then will reflect on the things that we benefit from. And this is was actually, it's, well, it's part of other studies that we are also conducting on how we benefit from soils and what are the visible effects of those benefits. But most of the impacts do not, it's not instantaneous. So we, for example, soil erosion is another aspect of this. Soil erosion is something that also is a danger for soil, so it also degrades soils. But when it happens, it also reflects something that happened before. So something happened before to those soils that degraded the communities that are there. Then you have soil erosion, and then you have a worse effect. So the problem with soils is a bit of that. So when you cut a forest, you see the forest gone, and you see the immediate effect. But with soils, something happens to them. You often do not see it, and then you see those effects afterwards.
And Eliana, so your part much more in this research is then to take all these data we have and I would say sort them to bring them in a kind of mathematical system or to show in a mathematic way what is the side effects, what's the effects beyond them and how it will go. And from the other side, from where it went, so is the mathematics you do one tool to look what happens in the past when you have data from today?
So the importance of mathematics and statistics is that you need a framework in which you can reflect your ideas. You need to organize your ideas. You need to understand when something causes something else. You cannot just jump on conclusions. And very often the mistake that you see in many newspapers is that correlation is not causation.
Yes.
You see that two things are correlated, but that does not imply that one causes the other. So in order to have like a clear understanding of what are, for example, the drivers of soil biodiversity, you need to first start with a reasonable mathematical and statistical approach to be able to frame it in this way. And so one way in which you can do that is by using a graphical model, which is that your variables are like clouds and you put arrows between the clouds. So for example, you would put like precipitation influences the community of bacteria. This is a way to illustrate like a causal relation. So with these models, we are able to represent causal relations in the system. And there are many, this is a very wide class of models which are currently being used widely in many areas, not just, of course, in soil ecology. But the power of this method is that you can use it to draw conclusions. So in a certain way, a graphical model organizes the observations that you obtain. And now, of course, once you are organized, then you would like to see if the way you organized your model allows you to answer the questions that you have. Okay, so for example, you would like to know what will happen in the future, right? So you have your data and you want to make predictions. And for that, you need to understand certain mathematical, statistical limitations. And the idea is that in this project in particular, we used one of these models to attempt to make predictions under different possible future scenarios of the development of things on Earth, for example.
Yeah, and one important thing here is that most research is done in a very... So there are several classes of models, but most research does not try to describe the entire system. We also did not describe the entire system, but the approach that Eliana was describing with these graphical models and to try to understand how things relate to each other allows us to have a more system perspective. Because, for example, rainfall does not influence directly, or not, it's not a direct path from rainfall to bacteria in the soil. It influences the plants that you have there. It influences other properties of the soil. And with this system representation, what you actually do is that you account for the influences, for example, of rainfall on the soil properties, on the soil pH, on the amount of vegetation that you have, And then you cascade those influences to what we have in the soil. And this is what this was part of our research in the paper that you referred to, but it's also part of our research in other studies, where we try to understand the system complexity a bit more and try to illustrate what is happening at the moment and what can happen in the future with that.
That's interesting, because in your paper you're writing that, the normal idea with coming about biodiversity in the ground is maybe, okay, the chemicals from industry and those things, this is a big impact. But you write, no, it's the climate change itself. Is this a good example for this effect that you have the climate change bringing less water, the less water bringing the plants are dying, the plants don't have the roots that are working with underground together with rain worms or whatever. So these kind of following and complex system effects.
Yeah. So in the particular paper that you're referring to, we don't account for directly, we don't account for pollution, for example. But this would be a good example of that. And for example, in our partnership, so ecologists and mathematicians, the critical point there is to find reasonable ways, so reasonably mathematically and both in mathematics and ecology, to represent these systems that we can then draw conclusions. But it's exactly like that. So we have different climate aspects like temperature, precipitation, and others that have a cascade of influences of more indirect effects that then are represented in the diversity of bacteria in the soil.
Yeah, and maybe like a cow, it's eating the plants and then comes behind out of the cow and you have different things that go with the rain later into the ground. You said it's a research looking into the future. How far does it go in your research into the future?
Well, we go. It depends a bit. So we try to go. There are two types of ways of predicting our future. Maybe Elena can explain how we did it mathematically, but what happens currently in research is that you can have independent estimates of our collective influence on the temperature. So for example, you can say, okay, up to 2050, we will produce this amount of carbon and globally, and that this is the effect of this amount of carbon on the atmosphere and for temperature, for example. And these effects vary in space. So, for example, in Germany, we may have an increase of 0.5 degrees, but I don't know, in Uganda, you can have an increase of 4 degrees because these effects vary from the region. But when you have these predictions, these are independent of the studies that we do. So what we do is we take those predictions and we feed them into our model. So we maintain the model structure, but we replace today's precipitation, for example, or temperature, by future temperature or future precipitation. And once we do that, we obtain a different representation of bacteria that reflects this increase or decrease in temperature or precipitation or changes in land use in the near future. And because of that, we try to do predictions for the next, so more short-term predictions like for 2030, 2040, but then in some cases it's useful to understand what is going to happen until 2100, because it gives policymakers a framework, a concept, an idea of what are the impacts of current policy on the future steps that we have. Because, for example, with the European Green Deal now, this is what is being done. So the policy is being shaped by research like the one that we did in order to make sure that policy being done today has an impact in the future that is a predictable impact in the right direction. Not all policy is done like that, but that's one of the ideas that we have. Maybe you can...
Yes, I wanted to elaborate on this future And the idea is that we are observing the system right now, and we have been observing like the soil. You know, we are observing it right now, and we have some observations from the past that can help us understand how it has evolved from the past up to now. And we now want to understand how it will evolve under different conditions to the future. And there are different challenges. I want to talk about, you know, we used a certain model and a certain data set to carry out the study, but I want to focus on the challenges, which are, you know, first we need to have a lot of data to be able to make predictions, and that is very often a constraint. You know, you cannot go and sample soils everywhere where you would like. That's one constraint. And then the other one is that you want to have a model that makes good predictions. But the thing is that, you know, how are you going to know that your model made a good prediction? So this is when more of the mathematical, statistical challenges come up. And, you know, graphical models are very popular in artificial intelligence and machine learning to do predictions. So we have an approach in the paper that we did, but, you know, part of the challenge is, you know, have more data and also try to develop more math and statistics to see what will the future be for soils specifically, for example.
There was, before I ask this, can you have maybe for people, we all have a computer at home, some are gaming with it, some have a few, for sure working, but some have few films on it or whatever, data, and the machine works with the data. Only for get a feeling about the mass of the data you used, can you bring this in a little bit in a scale between the normally maybe gaming computer wouldn't really work with this? What kind of machines do you use, and how long time it does sometimes for doing the calculation?
So it is. I'm trying to think how long did it take the computation, but I mean there is. First, there's the part in which you process the data and formulate a model, and then you have to run the model for like the changing parameters in the future, for example, climate, temperature.
Okay. Let me understand. So you took the data, and from this data you form the model, and then you use the model you have for looking what's coming in the future and so on to let run it. That's
right.
Okay.
So there comes the part on which you are building the model and understanding which is the model that you will use to make your predictions, and then you send it to Carlos and Carlos uses his computer to run this model in a map of the world where you have like a certain values of precipitation, temperature, and other variables to be able to make a prediction. And I think you would know better how long this did it take to run this model.
So it's possible to run, not in a normal computer, so not in a laptop, I would say.
Yeah.
But in a gaming laptop, maybe. What we actually do, so I did both IDIV and the MPI, have server clusters, so not a cluster like a scientific cluster. We also have access to those, but for this type of calculation, it's not necessarily the case, because we also, so these predictions, because of data constraints actually, and because of uncertainty, are done in a very, very large scale. So it's not going to predict Leipzig. So if you go to our map, let's put it like this, and you click in Leipzig, the predictions that you are getting for specifically for Leipzig are not useful, because it's one big area where everything has the same value. But so because of that, we don't have to go to scientific clusters, but we still use servers. So we use a dedicated server to do these calculations, and it's like a proper computer. So with, I don't know, in our case, I think it has like 64 cores and I think a terabyte of RAM, something like this, that does these calculations, and then they take some base. You know, it depends on how we do it.
Yeah, this would be a very, very good gaming laptop.
Well, not only with AMD.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's maybe good for you in the end that the gaming laptops are existing, because there's some science about these machines, and for sure it goes in every other, you can use it for other things. For sure not the gaming laptop, but the science behind it's fast calculating. It's not so bad.
But that's for sure. We have lateral benefits from developments in other areas. And this is not only on the machines in terms of like in computing. For sure, we receive benefits from that. But for example, from an ecology point of view, it's really beneficial to work with other people like mathematicians that are from completely different fields and see the advantages of bringing that science into, in this case, into ecology. Because, for example, without this collaboration, for sure, the model that or the paper that we did would not be as good as it is. So it would lack on probably on the mechanistic understanding of what is happening in soils globally, and we would lack other things for sure. So this type of collaboration, so having lateral benefits from other disciplines is for sure something that it's very positive for us.
Okay, yeah. From let's go back to your research coming from the machines that are doing it. We are still, since I have you a few days, 2 weeks, I think, 3 weeks in contact for this interview today. And in this time, or maybe a week before, I don't know, so around about this, there was something in Australia. And as I've seen in your research, I think this is a very good metaphoric maybe. I don't know. Maybe you can answer. There is, at the moment, there's the mass population of mice. Mice in Australia, big problem, and there we see exactly that the problems of the effects of the climate change and biodiversity crisis at all is not only that it goes less, it changes. So you have so much mice you never had. If there would be more kangaroos, there would be less mice maybe, and or mouses. I'm not sure if what's right in English. And you write that. It's in the future, it wouldn't become to the point that all the bacteria you have in the ground go less. It will grow up. So for the first moment, oh, that's good. But what's your answer?
Exactly. So the not all increases are good. Okay, that's the key word or the key message there. In the case of soils, what we see, not only, so this study only focuses on microbes, but coming from other studies, what we see is that microbes tend to thrive, so tend to increase their local richness, and invertebrates, for example, tend to decrease. So it's not positive for all groups, and different groups in the soil will have different impacts. What is happening, or what we show with our studies in the case of microbes, is that local richness, so the richness that you find in your, let's say, in your plot outside of your home, tends to increase. It's particularly in temperate systems. So it's a global phenomenon, but particularly in temperate systems, this tends to be the case. What happens is that it's not that you get more species. That's not what we are saying. Mm. What we are saying is that your plot outside of your home is going to have a tendency to be more equal to the plot of your neighbor or to the plot of someone else in Frankfurt. So what we are saying is that although locally you may have more species, these two sites, so your plot and the plot of your neighbor, are going to tend to be more equal rather than different. And for diversity's sake, what we want is to have different areas, different species, populating these different soils. And this is what you are finding, is that, yes, you have an increase or a potential increase in the local diversity, so the diversity that you find in each plot around the world. But this diversity is not from an increase in the total number of species, it's an increase in the total number of species locally, but overall for the region, we have actually a tendency to have an homogenization. So all places tend to be more equal between them. And that is not necessarily what we want.
Yeah, that's, there comes to the point, why don't we want? What is the effect if this goes like this?
There's a conservation effect. So imagine that you do the same. So it's easier probably to think in birds. So you do an assessment of all the birds in Europe, okay? Mm-hmm. And you see that in Germany you have four, and in the Netherlands you have another four, and I don't know, in France you have five. Let's put this in very simplistic terms.
Yeah.
But let's start with those being all different, okay? So all of them are different. So you have, in total, you have 13 different species. Now, 10 years later, I go and I say, okay, Germany now has five species, so increased one. Netherlands has five species, increased one, and France has five species, so it's the same. But I add another information saying, from the pool of 13 species, you actually now only have seven because you lost half of those. You locally, you have five species, so Germany even has another one. But now they are all equal to each other. So now there's almost no difference between the species in Germany and in the Netherlands and in France. Mm-hmm. And from a conservation point of view, this is quite critical because you may lose species that only exist in Germany. So, for example, there's a specific earthworm that only exists in Germany. It's an endemic species in the southwest of Germany. If you're local diversity increases, but you lose that species, you completely lose that species for the world. So having an increase in local diversity is not necessarily a positive thing, because from a conservation point of view, you want a diverse world. You don't want just locally many species and then they are all the same all over the world.
Yes, we don't only want this diverse world because it's nice to have it and to have different flowers I can bring in my house and it's nice to see them or like this. There are concrete effects. What's the ground? It's about the ground, the bottom. What's with industrial farming or farming at all? What effects will come maybe in the future? You see in a bit of far a scale if we don't take a break, if it goes like your research will do when it goes without stopping these problems. Is there the same effect that you have maybe that in the ground less diversity means less diversity of fruits we can farm, maybe like this?
Well, it means probably more problems to cultivate, because in a parallel research what we showed is that, so you see this increase in soil microbes with potential futures. But what we also see in parallel research is that increase comes with an increase in the proportion of soil pathogens. So what happens there is that, yes, your local diversity increases, but the amount of plant pathogens that you have in your local soil also increases. So if you think long term, this means that you probably have more diseases related to your cultivation. You may still plant the fruit, but maybe they are not that big because the plant struggles to have the fruits. So it has issues related to pathogenic influences on the plant. So local increases are good, but they have hidden within those local increases features that us humans and our society may not necessarily see as a benefit. And this is part of our research, is to understand where are the thresholds, where are the limits of the overall benefits that we get from soils and how those express in terms of local richness of soil organisms.
And where exactly we are staying now? What in this point? And where we are? Where's the scale going?
What staying in terms of?
Yeah, the term of there comes the point that it get really, really a big problem. For sure, if maybe in 200,000 years ago a volcano goes up, it's a problem for pollution the air. But okay, it goes through. But if there are many million and million of volcanoes, or maybe a mankind with all this CO2 then it comes to a point where it's a problem. The first maybe 200,000 cars in the world were a problem, but it goes more. No? And where you made this research and you see the points where it comes to really problems. And where are we in this now?
So this is where actually my collaboration with my mathematician friend comes handy, because the right answer to give you is we don't know. Mm-hmm. So the problem with most climate predictions, even the ones that aim for an increase of, let's say, 0.5 degrees in temperature, they are based on the collective experience in terms of research of what that could be in terms of consequences for society. But in reality, there is no defined threshold. So there's no way of saying that if Germany gets a 1 degree increase in temperature or a 1.1 degree increase in temperature, that there's a dramatic difference. So there's no way of us to point to a specific number and say that's the number. And this is the thing that this is what I can tell you about soils, or what we can tell you about soils, is that there's no specific number to say something like that.
Yeah. I also want to emphasize, and correct me if I am wrong, my ecological understanding is that for soil organisms, there is no really, as Carlos was pointing earlier, an atlas. There is no widespread consensus or this is the amount of biodiversity that we have right now. If this happens, then we will lose this amount of biodiversity. That does not exist. So understanding what are the different species and what they provide for the soil and the ecosystem is something that is not finished as of today. So understanding what is that number, which is the tipping point from we're losing it because the soil, is degrading, or we're losing species. There's not an understanding of that, because to get to that point, we need to understand much more about soil than what we understand today.
Yeah. But there's also another point of view to this, because while that is true, there are some things that we already know. So we already know that it's really important the number of pressures that you put into the soil. So let's say that you do farming, but you don't use pesticides. So you just go with a tractor and you plow. That is already a pressure to the soil. But if you put fertilizers, it's another pressure to the soil. And if you put pesticides, so when you stack up pressures, you will be going to get worse results, independently of the pressures. So if you put tractor fertilizer pesticide or tractor fertilizer something else, if it is a pressure on the soil, you will get the same type of worse results. So if we want to see, we still didn't evolve to do this in this type of study, but if you want to see it in that way, in economic terms, it's basically our threshold is where when the farmer loses the capacity to put inputs in the soil, so money into buying fertilizers, pesticides, and everything, and starts losing money because they have to put so much because the land doesn't give it anymore, that they don't win any money in the end. If we are there yet or not, in some regions of the world, yes, we are. We had massive immigration from North Africa because of issues related to soil fertility and to issues related to climate change, not only, of course, with also with war, but there are many things happening in the North of Africa that relate to food scarcity. And this is an issue related to soils and to soil degradation. Maybe in Europe, we're not there yet, but I prefer to prevent that future than to reach it.
So we talked much about the problems in biodiversity in the ground. So what's from the other side? What things are very good for this world down there? Maybe roots from from trees or plants, other plants. Maybe it's really the what falls on the back out of the cow or whatever. So what things, if I'm a politician, ask you, hey, I want to make my ground better. What should I do? What is the best for it?
Nowadays, I would have to say that you as a politician would have to have a nature conservation policy for soils. So we cannot any longer, there's no more time to look at soils from a farming perspective only. You still have to look at it from a farming perspective because you still have to grow food. And it's important to, for example, decrease land degradation in farmlands. So there are some measures, and in the case of Europe, actually, we have several already regulations, quite good regulations about preventing soil erosion, preventing land degradation. Now with the Green Deal, it's going to just, in that sense, it's going to be better. So we will have more regulations, probably more transparent regulations for farmers, hopefully, to halt land degradation in farms. The problem is that soils outside of farms are invisible to everyone, not only to the farmers, but to everyone, like all. And we need a policy. So if you are a politician, what we need is a nature conservation policy for soils, where the same way that you target a specific plant or a specific forest or a specific bird, you also target specific soil animals to promote their habitat and to promote their conditions. And this will vary from species to species and from area to area. But there are several studies that, for example, point out to, in the case of forests, there's this mechanism of dead wood. So you just basically, you see a tree falling and you leave it be. So you leave the tree in the middle of the forest, just degrading. And that actually creates habitats for soil organisms. There are several management orientations that one can follow after a policy decision like having a nature conservation policy for soils is made. But first we have to go this step further, that we are still not there yet.
Yeah, something we have to do in every part of biodiversity crisis and climate change, holding the systems alive. For sure, we can talk much longer. I don't have, there would be questions much, but if I would maybe end with the open part. So if you have something you really want to say, you say, okay, maybe this is the essence of your research, or maybe some big more personal, how it drives you to do this or what else. I would give you now, the time to, say something I don't have to ask for, because maybe I don't know the question.
Let's see. What I would like to say is that we're talking with this scientists for future, right? And I think a good part of the future relies on strong mathematics, of having sound theories, of like having the tools to understand the world around us, so that we can have a better future. So maybe your audience doesn't see it this way, but I'm a mathematician, and I think really mathematics is part of the scientists for the future.
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
What I would say, not as eloquently as my colleague, but what I would say is that, because you have a German public, Germany is actually doing a lot. Right now, in this precise moment in time, a lot to develop the future of soil research and of soil protection. There's the BFN. So the BFN is a German agency for biodiversity monitoring, and now they are investing a lot of time, a lot of resources into the future of soil monitoring in Germany. There is also, for example, in the case of the nature protection, there is actually some states that have specific regulation for the protection of soils. So Germany, in the broad spectrum of things, is actually very well positioned. Nevertheless, Germany does not have a nature conservation policy that includes soils. and this is visible across the different protected areas across Germany, where we see that the management plans do not refer to soils as a protection system, but as something that provides, for example, habitat for other plant species or for other species of interest. So for the future and for your audience, it's important that we at least educate ourselves and educate politicians also as part of our societal agreement that this this policy has to be clear from the start. So when you create a new protected area, it's not only the birds that you should worry about. It's not only the plants or the forest that you should worry about. It's not that hard to make a hole in the soil and see what is out there, to see if you have something special that you should really care about and that you, for now, you are not caring.
Okay, Carlos, Eliana, thank you very much for this insight in your research.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.